Science Faction is for adults only, and can only be purchased in Alabama from a state store that's closed on Sundays.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to Science Faction, the only show where a scientist, a comedian, and a comedian scientist come together to discuss science comedically.
And welcome to Science Faction 247, Science Faction Pathology.
That is the science of tracking things, of following...
You're following a path, right? Yes.
Yeah, like Indian trackers.
Exactly. No, this is the study of disease, Damien, which is something you should be familiar with as the many diseases that you have.
They're all curable, though,
yeah, they're
right?
Listen, if it's not in the curing of diseases, I don't want to know about it.
Indeed, there are many different types of pathology. You can have anatomical pathology, where you're looking at the diagnosis of disease based on the examination of different organs and tissues and stuff. You're looking at the physical body. You can have different parts of that, different subsets, like dermopathology, looking at diseases of the skin, cytopathology, looking at diseases at the cellular level. So you're actually looking down at a microscope into cellular disease. So we could have things like mitochondrial disease that would fit into that category. You can have neuropathology, where you have some kind of disease of the brain, which can or cannot be related to some kind of mental pathology. So that we know that there are mental disorders. We refer to them as mental diseases and mental pathologies. Sometimes that is associated with a neuropathology. There's a physical damage or physical problem with the brain that then causes a mental problem. But sometimes there's not, at least as far as we can tell. It seems to just be a mental issue. So if somebody has, for instance, PTSD, and that leads them into certain mental pathologies, there might not actually be something physically wrong with their brain, as in neuropathology. It might just be mental. So there's a bunch of different types of pathology that we can study. You might recognize the name from words that you hear commonly, like psychopath. That's a psychopathology, or somebody with a disease of the brain that causes them to not only not feel emotions, but to take pleasure in the pain of other people.
Yeah, I see that a lot in my paperwork, and I don't know what it
means. Yeah, you know, speaking of your diseases.
You got a cure for that?
No, but I feel like right under psychopathology, under your list of diseases, they had can't win, I call BS.
That is not true. I won last week. You're already rewriting history.
Are you sure? I don't remember that.
You were an Orwellian fucking science comedy podcast
Don't
host.
Trust the media or Damien when they talk about winning, I call BS.
So did you actually have a guest, or was it just a default win?
No, I don't think he won. I'm pretty sure we had Naomi I think that he lost by two or three points.
Go back, listen to the tapes.
I mean, I don't know. Those tapes don't exist. I'm not sure. It's like those moon recording tapes. We recorded over it. We had some sweet episodes of Dallas in the 80s we wanted to tape. We recorded over that.
Stupid.
Sorry.
Daughter's recital.
Speaking of your daughter's recital, I, of course, am your host, comedian archaeologist Robert Timothy. And with me, as always, is my comedian, Mr. Damien Mercado. Damien, how you doing this afternoon?
I'm doing great. You feel your daughter's recital, you're a great dad. I film your daughter's recital, I'm kicked out of the auditorium.
You've got some kind of pathology. And our scientist for the evening, Ian. Ian, how you doing?
I'm doing fantastic.
Good to have you back, Ian, and good to have all you listeners back. Thank you so much. We've been seeing our rising numbers. We really appreciate it. And to our new listeners out there, or our old ones, if you want to help us out, we don't ask for your money. We don't have any advertisers you need to go to. All we ask for is this. Please subscribe and write us a review on iTunes. We're going to start doing an interesting bit with our reviews on iTunes. So if you want to be part of that bit, go ahead and make sure you get a review in before it gets so crowded with reviews that you're unable to make the time.
If you're, for some reason, unable to leave a 5-star review in iTunes as well as a comment, then please just send nudes.
That works too. Don't make it of your daughter's recital, though. We're already saying that. We don't want to be involved in that kind of trafficking. That's going to bring us some bad press.
Well, not your daughter's recital.
Yeah, no, but of course not. That would be even creepier.
And just people scouting out pictures, like the CIA is following you. There's a Bobby dossier out there.
Undoubtedly there is. And if you guys want to contact us by Twitter, you can tweet us at Faction Science, where you can either just send us a random tweet of a science article you think is interesting, or you can send us your suggestion for Ask Bobby an Ungoogleable Question, our favorite new bit, where you ask me some kind of subjective scientific question that cannot necessarily be Googled, such as, what is the next greatest technology that will change the human race?
What will it take for Bobby to acknowledge Damien's victory and I call BS?
Just a victory. Just a single victory one time. That's all that would take.
I just had no idea that you had a memento-like amnesia disease. So I need to tattoo, after my victory today, I need to tattoo you, all over your face.
You're going to have to tattoo.
With my balls.
The first time you win, I will let you put a tattoo on. But we'll tackle that when it comes. I feel like we're doing the whole thing when I'm like, yeah, when we get to cold fusion, then we'll have the discussion.
Cold fusion. Nobody's going to be happy with cold fusion. Everybody will be happy with my balls tattooed tattooed on your forehead.
Oh, and speaking of balls on my forehead, let's move right on to science articles.
From molecules to particles, this is Science Articles.
Article number one, a hidden carbon source. This one is super interesting. And by the way, we are going to try a little bit of a new thing on Science Faction this week, both for this Sunday's episode and this Thursday's episode. Not only am I going to kind of summarize the article for you, I'm actually going to read you the abstract directly from the author to get a little bit of a viewpoint as to what they're saying. So let's start with this.
I mean, isn't this also an attempt to make this podcast more exhilarating?
Yeah, that's true. I was like, you know what? It doesn't have enough dry science language.
Could you at least forward it to me the night before so I could punch up the abstract?
Will you just tag it with dick jokes here and there?
I would love it if it's even lazier than that. I just put penis emoticon, like something you can't even read or translate into podcast format.
What does this eggplant emoji mean? All right, so let's talk about this one. This is a really interesting article that has to do with a very unfortunate thing, which is we've just found another source of greenhouse gases basically being leaked into the atmosphere by something that we didn't even realize was doing it, which changes the calculation of how much of an impact we're having in terms of greenhouse gases, because we hadn't accounted for this before. And this happens to be a not too small source of greenhouse gases too, because the actual thing itself is quite plentiful. It is unfortunately plastic. So we have recently found that plastics are leaching greenhouse gases into the air. And even worse, it's not that it's CO2, the gas that's already bad enough. It is methane, which, as we've discussed on this show before, is about 26 times as powerful a greenhouse gas as CO2.
Never fucking oxygen.
Yeah,
never.
Right? Why doesn't it leak gold? Wouldn't that be better if it's just like, yeah, when the plastic gets too hot in the ocean, it just turns to gold and tits?
Yeah, can we get a chemist on this show so I can yell at him about how come our plastic doesn't decompose into gold or chocolate chip cookies?
All right, so let me read you this abstract real quick. Mass production of plastic started nearly 70 years ago, and the production rate is expected to double over the next two decades. While serving many applications because of their durability, stability, and low cost, plastics have deleterious effects on the environment. Plastic is known to release a variety of chemicals during degradation, which has a negative impact on biota. Biota being life, of course. Here we show that most commonly used plastics produce two greenhouse gases, methane and ethylene, when exposed to ambient solar radiation. Polyethylene, which is the most produced and discarded synthetic polymer globally, is the most prolific emitter of both gases. We demonstrate that the production of trace gases from virgin low-density polyethylene increases with time, and the rates at the end of a 212-day incubation of 5.8 nanomoles per gram to the negative one. You know, I'm going to skip the measurements on this particular abstract.
I was good, because I was like trying to envision what a nanomole looks like.
I would say Damien was kind of falling asleep over there.
Yeah, basically environmentally...
Strong dicks,
I'll skip after it. Basically, they're giving the actual rates of degradation. Environmentally aged plastics incubated in water for at least 152 days also produced hydrocarbon gases. In addition, low-density polyethylene emits these gases when incubated in air at rates 2 times and 76 times higher than when incubated in water for methane and ethylene, respectively. Our results show that plastics represent a heretofore unrecognized source of climate-relevant trace gases and are expected to increase as more plastics is produced and accumulated in the environment. So here's why this is scary. Number one, we've talked about this before. Methane is a much stronger greenhouse gas than CO2. It's one of the reasons that cows, for instance, are really bad in terms of climate change because they produce a lot of methane with their farts. That is really bad for the environment. Methane itself, when it gets bled off as, for instance, natural gas, is really bad for the environment if we don't burn it up. So what we're finding is that when we did these calculations before, we added in cars and industry and cows. We didn't add in plastics because we didn't realize that their breakdown releases this methane. Methane is really, really bad. And it's even worse because, as was stated in the abstract, polyethylene is the most produced and discarded synthetic polymer, and it's the most prolific emitter of both gases. Think of the Pacific garbage patch or other things like that. We are creating this super zone of methane production slash litter by letting plastics out into the environment.
So what you're saying is this problem will solve itself. The ocean will eventually break down all the plastic in there.
Into methane, and then it'll heat and boil away.
And then we'll have that sweet methane.
Yeah, that's right. This is a really big problem, and climate change in general is a really big problem, but when we have these runaway effects, you know, the hotter it gets, the more those plastics are going to break down. We keep putting more plastics into the environment, and we have these runaway type compounding effects where it gets hotter, plastics break down more. The more they break down, the more methane they put out, the hotter it gets. So it makes things like the effort to pick up garbage throughout the oceans and even in our own landfills really, really important. You know, we see some of these garbage skimming boats that people are creating that essentially go out and they run on solar power and they go through and they skim the trash off the surface. It might be that those are really, really important because keeping that stuff from degrading out into the atmosphere might be the difference between hitting the tipping point or not in terms of, you know, massive climate change. The fact is we're going to get a few degrees no matter what. All of the math says that we're going to hit a few degrees no matter what. But there is a difference between 2 to 3 degrees of warming, which, by the way, is still huge. That's gigantic. And 8 degrees of warming. And if you want to put this in perspective, I think the last global ice age, on average, it was something like 4 to 5 degrees difference. So think of between here and when glaciers came down and covered half the earth, that was only a few degrees. So a few degrees difference, you know we're going to warm a little bit, that's going to suck, but a few degrees difference can still be major. So if we can find ways to kind of take some of these leaks of greenhouse gases out of the environment, it's really important.
I think I might have just solved this specific garbage problem. It's interesting that years from now, people will look at this moment as the moment that the Pacific garbage crisis was solved. It's going to require significant capital investment if we're going to pay people to do this.
Right, to take the plastic out of the water.
Plus, you're creating a lot of carbon, getting the boats out there and everything, you know.
I mean, not well, the solar the, boats,
the
but...
solar power.
Yeah. Arguably, you can say the production of the boat itself had some kind of carbon thing. You had to produce the materials to make the boat and the solar cells itself. But
and I would
unless
argue
they make
this.
It out of garbage plastic.
Ooh, that's good.
But you know who you don't need to pay? Whales. And you know what the ocean is filled with? Whales.
That's true.
I'm
actually,
saying
I don't think they are anymore.
The honorable Japanese are doing their best to rid the...
to keep those bully whales from picking on these fish all day.
To rid the ocean of these sea terrorists. But until that day, could we set up some sort of saddle? I mean, you don't need to ride the whale.
Right.
I mean, it'd be cool if you could.
Yeah.
But essentially something that just has some like huge hefty bags along the side, like a net. Like
okay,
a,
like, I like so, this. Well, let's take saddle out and let's use the term yoke. You know, like something we would put on an oxen to pull a plow. And then we have huge nets that tow behind. Maybe we'll have two whales, each with a yoke, and then a giant like 2 mile net.
And then, like, once the net gets full, we have something that, look, just ties it off. And yes, that, and then that sinks to the bottom of the ocean. Yes, that's additional trash, but at least it's localized.
Isn't it
going to pull the whale down, too?
No, they have a detach, like a quick release.
A blue whale is the largest animal to ever live on the planet and lives in a low-gravity environment. This is a weight training program, if anything.
Believe
this
it or not, Damien's plan, while outlandish, it could theoretically work in the sense that if you do sink the trash, you are keeping it from going into that carbon cycle because it's not being exposed to the sunlight, which breaks it down. So you wouldn't have the methane release if it was down low. In fact, one theory for reducing carbon emissions has always been you have this breadbasket of America in the Midwest, right? And they all produce a whole bunch of corn and other crops.
That's a really interesting way of saying the shitty part of America.
Yes, it's true. One of the ideas that somebody had that they did, they literally did all the math back of the envelope calculations and realized we could take a dramatic cut in carbon emissions is right now when they're done with those corn stalks and everything else. So think of not the stuff you actually eat, but the vast majority of the biota that's created when you grow an ear of corn is just trash waste, right? It's the stalk of the corn. It's the leaves of the corn. It's not the stuff you're eating. Now they usually put that in the middle of the field and they burn it and then they kind of spread it, the ashes around. That's a huge carbon release. But a huge carbon sink would be if you took all that stuff, tossed it on a raft in the Mississippi River, floated it down to the Gulf of Mexico and sank it to the bottom of the Gulf. And that would essentially be a carbon capture sink where you would keep that carbon from being re-released into the atmosphere. There are some back of the envelope calculations that says just something like that in a few localized places would have a dramatic effect on climate change. So Damien's not that far off when he says we should take that plastic and sink it. While that may be littering and horrible and everything, at least we're already littering. At least we'd keep the planet from warming up in the process.
That's why you bring me on the show, is for the big science ideas.
That's right.
Ian.
So there's a couple of questions that we should ask. One is, can we produce plastics that don't do this? Can we produce plastics that don't emit these either hydrocarbons, which we've discovered that these do as well, or methane as they are degrading? Right now, no, because the chemical components of these particular things basically break down. This is just the facts, the chemistry of how this works. When exposed to solar radiation, they are going to break down. So you got to switch the question around from, can we produce these plastics that wouldn't do this, to can we produce plastics that we would use in a different way so as they wouldn't end up in the environment? And my answer to this is yes. I've shared this before, but I think it's an idea that would actually change the world. I think it's something that we could do to greatly improve both our littering, our recycling ability, our ability to produce things. Very simple. We are about to live in the era of 3D printers. To some extent, we already do, right? And once we do, it's not going to be that you have to go out to the store to get everything you want. You're going to download the plans for a lot of the stuff you want and literally print it out at home. But you're going to need the base material for that printing, the ink to the 3D printer. So if we could start producing plastics, let's say the wrapping to your Oreos or the packaging that whatever you just bought comes in, instead of throwing it away, throwing that plastic away that's going to end up in the ocean or a landfill and be broken down into these methane gases, what if we made this stuff instantly and easily recyclable in the home? And that recyclable thing, let's say you have a big hopper in your house and it's basically a garbage disposal hooked up to a big hopper, and you tossed your plastics in there. So you're done with your 2-liter bottle of Coke, you toss that in there. You're done with the wrapping to your Oreos, you toss that in there. You hit the button, it breaks it all up. And then now that broken up plastic becomes the ink for your 3D printer. So you would never throw things like that away. You would basically get all the wrapping that you have now, which we need for certain safety things for food. You know, you need to have that stuff wrapped and sealed. Instead of throwing it in a garbage heap, you throw it in your 3D printer, and that becomes the next thing you print out when you want something.
So it's kind of like plastic composting.
Exactly. That's a good analogy. Yeah. Like, I think you just need to create the right synthetic plastic that can be easily reused and broken down continuously, something that doesn't need to be heated super high to be broken down. Now, you'd have to strike a balance, right? Because obviously the wrapping of your food would have to be able to maintain some kind of stability, some kind of chemical stability when it gets heated during transfer and stuff. But I think we can do it. And I think the benefit would be huge, because if you did it enough, if you got really good at it, you could essentially eliminate litter. There's no reason we need a trash can full of trash if most of that stuff could actually be of economic benefit to us and be the next thing you need to print out, a part for your car, a plate for your kitchen, whatever it is.
An AK-47.
Thank you. This is America, and we're legally allowed to print that
out. Own a Russian-designed rifle.
Right.
I'm actually seeing some advantages to this. Like, I am a huge fan of peanut butter. Love the taste, love the smell.
Mm-hmm.
My dog loves the taste, loves the smell.
I've read that about you.
Synthesize this.
Yes. Sometimes you do it at little kid recitals.
It's a symbiotic relationship.
Yeah.
And I'm sorry for interrupting the recital. To be fair, my dog was hungry. What was I supposed to do? Yeah. Let him ruin the recital?
Yeah.
But you didn't have to let him lick it off your balls.
Yeah.
I don't tell you how to train your dog. Listen, I have an established method. What is he gonna? He's not going to know what to do if I give it to him off my hand in public. I'm not going to throw him that curveball. He's going to embarrass me in public.
Damien got a tattoo across his balls that says dog bowl.
So, I mean, it'd be great if I could just not clean out my peanut butter thing that well and then melt it down. Then every plastic thing I have would have the smell of peanut butter.
That's true.
Plus, I'd get to kill a lot of children with allergies.
That's also true. Yeah, toughen them up a little bit too. I really think that is the idea of the future. That kind of personal recycling where you could almost eliminate, 90, 95% of your trash waste. I mean, obviously it wouldn't work for biological waste, but you could compost that. So if you mixed it with standard composting, you throw your banana peels and your kitchen scraps into a compost heap, you throw your plastics and all that other stuff into your plastic hopper / recycler for your 3D printer. And all of a sudden, not only do we not have to have all this trash going out of our house, but we also don't have to drive to the store to buy the things we currently do, which obviously produces carbon as well, because we can print them out in our own house.
I'm really glad your idea didn't involve sinking whales.
Yeah. No, we weren't going to sink the whales, Ian. That would be cruel. We were going to use them as slave labor to gather trash that we would sink to the bottom of the ocean.
You're underestimating the amount of cruelty a whale can endure, sir. Watch the cove.
Yeah. Damien knows this. He once put peanut butter on his balls for a whale.
I hope it wasn't a narwhal. That'd be a little...
I handled the other end just fine.
He's into some kinky shit. All right, on to article number 2. We perceive reality through the lens of previous memories. I love this article because this one looks at something that is one of those interesting little tweaks of psychology. We believe that we perceive the world as it truly is, and that's just not true in so many ways. For instance, we only see a narrow band of light. In fact, there's much more stuff going on around us than we possibly know. We just don't perceive it because we can't see in the infrared and we can't see in the ultraviolet. Some animals can. They literally see things going on that we don't. We have this narrow band of what we consider reality, and then we think that is the existence of the world, that's the totality of it. Well, the fact of the matter is, not only are we limited by the physical aspects of our senses, the wavelengths of light we can see, the certain sound levels that we can hear, we're also limited by our perception and the reality of that perception. So we think we are experiencing the world, but in fact, a lot of times we're experiencing kind of almost a memory of the world. We have these little parts that we fill in. If you think about it, a lot of you probably know that the human eye has a blind spot on it. Well, you don't see that blind spot because your brain makes up for it. It takes visual cues from around it, from the other eye, and essentially fills it in. That blind spot where your optical nerve plugs in, you don't experience that on a day-to-day basis because your brain makes up for it.
Where is this blind spot?
It's right where the optical nerve plugs in. So if you close one eye, you can actually play with. There's a trick where if you close one eye, so you're not making up for it, you can move around and play with it and like put people's heads in your blind spot and make them look decapitated and stuff. So you can play with it. There's a lot of little tricks you can do with it.
Like a kickflip.
Yeah.
A sweet 900.
But your brain does the same thing with your memories and your constant perception of what's going on around you. You don't actually perceive everything going on. A lot of things you're essentially filling in with old memories, the same way your brain fills in that blind spot with other visual cues. So if you do something, it seems like the key is you remember differences. So if we're walking around and we're doing our normal thing, so let's say you just roll out of bed every morning, get up and start washing your face, and you do the exact same thing every morning no matter what. If I ask,
slather the peanut butter all over your
groin. Yeah, get the peanut butter on it. Right, you got to cover the tattoo. That's the point.
Now the dog's fat. Now I have to walk the dog.
Yeah. So if you do the same thing every single morning, then what you're less likely to do is remember that thing that you just did. In fact, what you do is your brain just kind of fills it in with normal morning routine. What you remember is the differences. You remember the parts that you do differently. So let me read you the abstract. Memory for related past experiences can guide current perceptions. However, memory can lead one astray if situational features have changed. Thus, to adaptively use memory to guide perception, one needs to retrieve relevant memories and also to register differences between remembered and current events. Event memory retrieval and comparison theory proposes that observers associatively activate memories of related previous experiences and that this guides their ongoing perception. Conflicts between previous and current event features can hurt immediate performance, but if changes are registered and encoded, they can lead to highly effective encoding of the prior event, current event, and the relationship. In other words, when you have a change, not only do you remember that change better and the event better, you actually remember the previous thing better because of the difference. You're comparing the difference. Disruption of these mechanisms can play a role in older adults' greater susceptibility to event memory interference. Two experiments tested this hypothesis by asking participants to watch movies depicting two fictive days of an actor. Some activities were repeated across days, others were repeated with a changed feature, like waking up to an alarm clock or a phone alarm, and others were performed only on day two. 1 week after watching the day two movie, participants completed a cued recall test. Changes that participants detected but did not remember led to productive interference and recall. But changes that were successfully detected and remembered led to facilitation, meaning if they noticed a change, they would then remember that thing better. Because again, we're remembering changes or differences, not things that are the same. Younger adults detected and remembered more changes than older adults, which partly explained older adults' differential memory deficit for changed activities. These findings suggest a role for episodic reminding of events perception and a potential source of differences in event memory. Basically, we can now say, if you recognize these changes, you will then remember the thing better. So if anything is different in your life, in your day-to-day routine, you're more likely to remember it. Now, that leads us to a bias, right? So if we're reporting something, for instance, we're talking to some witnesses who saw something in court. If the day is exactly normal, every way it normally is, and it goes through the day, they're less likely to remember the specifics of that day. If something wild or outlandish happens in the middle of it, you're much more likely, and we've all probably experienced that.
I'm picturing the video of an actor that they used was, they showed the actor every day and it was Luis Guzman doing a monologue. And then like on the fifth one, on the different one, he's doing it in a British accent. And that's what
I think it'd be funnier if it was Luis Guzman doing it. And then like on the last one, it's actually Arnold Schwarzenegger with a Luis Guzman mask doing it. So he's got the different accent and he's way bigger.
Hi, Poppy.
Like, man, Luis Guzman's really taking care of himself.
I wonder how this relates to, there's another experiment that was done, and you can probably find videos of it, where participants were told, you know, to like count a certain number of people, you know, in a video. And in the middle of a video, a man in a gorilla suit comes walking across.
This is a famous experiment. They're supposed to count how many times a basketball gets passed between people in the video. And so they're sitting there counting back and forth. And in the background, a dude kind of walks by like the...
I don't even think it's in the background. I think it's in the foreground.
And the gorilla turns and says, as a little boy growing up in Puerto Rico...
I had to lick peanut butter off Damien's balls. That's a good point because, you know, in this case, what it is your memory is occupied. Your current perception of reality is occupied by watching what's going on in the ball movement. And you're not registering the difference, which is that guy in the monkey suit walking by in the background. Because of that, you don't remember it. And you will remember. You can talk to people. And this, I did this experiment in undergrad. Most people do. There's Psych 101. They'll show you the video. When you remember that video, you remember people passing the basketball. You don't remember this guy in the video walking background, who's very clear when they when the professor then replays it, you see it, you're like, oh shit, he wasn't hidden. You want to yell at them. You're like, that's a different video, bro. You totally changed the video. It's the same video. You just don't recognize it. It changes your memory because your original memory of that event does not have that guy walking through it.
It is actually this psychological effects that allows gorillas to move about unseen in modern day society.
Yeah, just walking casually through wearing a business suit like a Hanna-Barbera cartoon.
Is that how you get around?
Yeah, I'm giving away the secrets of the gorillas here, but do it. Just drive home today on your way home, wherever you are, Europe, America, wherever you're a fan, look for a gorilla and you'll find them.
You'll see them. They're all over the place. 30% of Uber drivers are technically lowland mountain gorillas.
They're like Pokemon. We're all over.
Yeah, no, totally true story. But it is interesting because I always love things like this that prove that our memory is not great recall. It's something that we've proved over and over again, especially in the past few decades. Our memories are very bad recorders of the reality of the situation. That's one of the reasons that in science, we want to write down all of the specifics. We want to take precise measurements. We want to videotape and take pictures because our memory is not that great when it comes to an objective recall of what happened.
I agree. I should start video recording I call BS.
Yes, you should.
Because objectively, your memory is fucking
maybe
terrible and purposely so.
At some point, you could actually win one if you took enough tape and studied it like a quarterback like Monday morning.
I won last week.
Did you?
Release the tapes.
I don't think so.
Haven't the tapes been released?
Yeah, technically they're already released, and I think they speak for themselves.
And here's the thing, he edits them. He listens to them more than anybody.
That's true.
But he does it so frequently, it's just a common occurrence he doesn't remember.
This cocky motherfucker doesn't even bother to edit out the actual win, and then comes on and denies it here.
It's funny, and it's interesting what our experiences are kind of tweaked by in terms of how we remember things being done versus, you know, like the situations in which they are done in. So one of the things that is interesting, I'm leading a field school right now where we're teaching a bunch of undergrads how to do archaeology up in the mountains, and we've had some pretty hot days recently. So we have an objective measure, which is
your students have requested you put on more clothing on hot days.
Yeah, stop letting that gorilla come out with us.
The weather is not an excuse for nudity, sir.
One of the things that's an objective recording measure is how many artifacts you record on a given day, right? So that's pretty objective. I recorded 200 lithics, 50 ceramics. I have this total number of 250 artifacts. So there's an objective measure of how much work gets done. But as the heat gets up, when you ask the students how much work they've done, they overestimate their work in the heat and underestimate it when it's cool. So if I say, you know, we have a goal of getting this much done, what is your production today? And if by 11:30 it's already 105 degrees, they'll overestimate their production. They'll say, oh, I've done way more than I did yesterday, when they've done way less, because the heat makes it harder. Because they're gauging it by how hard it is, they think they've done more work. So it is interesting. I've even noticed this in everyday life. Our perceptions of the reality of the world around us are heavily influenced by these outside factors that we don't even think about. Are we hungry at the moment we recorded it? Are we thinking about something that's pissed us off the night before? Or are we happy and kind of moving through it and going through work? That's why when people kind of get in the groove, they can end up, you know, you get in that zone and you can get a whole bunch of work done, or you can run like 5 extra miles.
I know what you mean. Like when I'm hungry, I always remember myself in that event as Joe Pesci. And I want a Snickers, and a Snickers.
Oh, yeah, it's because you're very angry and upset. I see.
Yeah, and I didn't want to wait.
I see. I thought it was because you were going to put an ice pick through the balls of that guy who shot up the club.
No, I just did that to some random Irish immigrant.
Very, very interesting article. And it's one of those things that always make us question, you know, is your life a lie? No, but your perception of it probably is. It's good to objectively sit back and measure that every once in a while. Let's move right on to a bit that most people have complained about. They said they didn't want to hear anymore.
The UN Human Rights Council has complained many times.
They've said, you know, if we can just kind of stop doing this bit, it would be great. But
it doesn't involve peanut butter, does it?
No, it doesn't, though it does involve the person who is a fan of that. Let's move right on to the very poorly outlined bit. Damien channels a dead scientist.
And now, Damien channels a dead scientist.
Don't go fuck yourself.
All right, for those of you guys who don't know, Damien channels a dead scientist is a bit where Damien shakes a little bit, pretends that he's in a trance, imagines that he has somehow gotten, I don't know, filled with the spirit of another person, whatever that means, and then tries to fool me and another scientist into thinking that he is that person.
That is one interpretation, certainly.
Yeah,
another,
the correct one.
Another is that something is happening in front of Bobby that he doesn't understand.
Mm-hmm.
And instead of accepting the majesty of the situation, a scientist, somebody who has changed the world, somebody who knows vastly more than him, is into the room. He essentially decides to get into a science dick measuring contest. And instead of using this resource, attacks this resource. Not that I have any memory of anything that happens.
No, not at all.
Damien can't handle that I go Super Saiyan, level up, and I'm the best scientist in the room. And again, even though I have no recollection of this happening, I surrender my body, and I become a vessel.
All right, Damien, let's hear it.
All right, Ian, would you turn down the lights for a second? The spirits don't like the light. All right. Let me summon this. Spirits.
Yeah, I like how he has to say spirits to get the spirit. That's the way it works.
Spirits. Yo, yo, yo.
What is this? Richard. Is this a hip-hop scientist?
Yo, it's...
It's Dr. Dre. He's not dead yet.
Richard the D-Man Feynman has been all mystically summoned and shit.
Oh, you're Richard Feynman.
Yeah, Richard Feynman. I'm sorry. I have a bit of an accent. People find it odd to understand me and shit.
You do have an accent, though. I don't know that that's really hitting it right, but okay.
Hold on, wait. Am I been summoned to that old penis-y podcast? Star Talk? Oh!
This is really more of a Dice Clay, but okay.
Dice Clay was doing the tribute to the Feynman every
time. Oh, okay.
To the Feynman. But Science Faction, well, Wilmot's freaking Science Faction. I love this show. I have it on the background when I'm humping. Oh, okay. I've been married 3 times that I know of. So, yeah, I was a world-renowned theoretical physicist and shit. You know, the physics world ranked me as one of the top 10 physicists of all time. And in college, MIT News, which is the local college publication for those of you who weren't smart enough to get into MIT and shit, ranked me as most likely to bang your sister 4 years running.
Really?
Yeah, ask me about what you're more proud of. Go ahead and ask.
What are you more proud of?
The banging your sister! Oh!
By the way, just those of you who are out there, you should listen to the Richard Feynman lectures on YouTube. They're fantastic. They're one of the greatest pieces of public science education. And while the accent is too much Dice Clay, it's not as far off as you might think.
Whoa! You're talking to Richard Feynman.
Sorry.
You will hear no difference between my voice and any sort of YouTube video, which certainly exists of my fine ass voice.
Why don't you tell the fans what it is you're famous for, Richard?
Well, I'm known for many accomplishments. The path of integral formulation of quantum mechanics, that's probably going to be your first hit on Google or any sort of Wikipedia page, I would imagine. This is pretty big. You know, I did a lot of work in the theory of quantum electrodynamics, the physics of superfluidity of supercooled liquid helium. I also proposed the Parton model, which is a model of hadrons such as protons and neutrons. It's useful for interpreting the cascades of radiation. No big deal. Mm-hmm. No big whoop. The Feynman diagrams, and creating countless uncles by banging countless sisters.
So, oh, is that how it happened?
So do you call them Feynman diagrams?
No, I wouldn't. I mean, I'm not some like sort of pretentious cock over here, you know. Now, if it was like a diagram of like, you know, like some sort of like vulva or something, yeah, I'd call that. I have many, many unpublished diagrams. That was a famous thing. When I was a student, I've always believed in maps. One of my anatomy professors, when we were dissecting a cat, I asked where the map to the cat was, because that's the way I thought freaking things worked.
All right, Richard, you got anything else to tell us about your life before we expose the fact that you're actually just Damien doing a bad Andrew Dice Clay impression?
Andrew Dice Clay was doing a very poor Richard the D-Man Feynman impression.
All right.
But yeah, I also was a popularizer of science. I wasn't just some asshole out there revolutionizing the world of physics and quantum mechanics. I also was a writer. I wrote There's Plenty of Room at the Bottom, which was a guide to ass play.
Okay, yeah, I don't think that's what it was.
Well, only somebody who read the book would know.
Okay.
I also wrote the semi-autobiographical Surely You're Joking, Mr. Feynman, and that was a guide to avoiding the sexual consequences of sexual harassment in the worst place.
Oh, I thought it was, I thought the subtitle was And Don't Call Me Shirley.
I was a big airplane fan too, hey!
Yeah.
Lastly, I wrote What Do You Care What Other People Think? Parentheses, it says, because you're banging their sisters.
What? All right. Now it's time for us to ask Damien.
Yeah, that's right. Ask me whatever questions you got. I got a hot date with the Lascelli twins and then a meetup with Rosalind Franklin later.
Wow. I say you're really banging scientists up there, huh?
Well, the Lascelli twins, you know, they're from Queens.
Okay, fair enough. I got a few questions. One of the first ones, though, not necessarily a question directed toward you, but one of the interesting things I noticed is that Feynman was a big popularizer of science. And interestingly, the science community actually turns on popularizers of science. They actually look at it negatively. It's one of the negative things about the science community, and we're starting to change that. But take Carl Sagan, for example. Carl Sagan was an accomplished scientist in his own right. He's the one who discovered the runaway greenhouse effect on Venus. He made a lot of discoveries himself in terms of astronomy and cosmology, and yet he was denied entrance to scientific organizations. He was denied recognition for his work because
he's part of my pickup crew, bro.
Oh, yeah.
Me and Sagan go out cruising on the town. And okay. Faraday, me, Faraday, he has a fedora, sweet fedora.
You're like the Brat Pack, but up in the scientific afterlife.
Oh, man, we're tearing up P up there.
It's funny because they really excluded Sagan from a lot of things because he was a popularizer. And they're like, yeah, you may be a scientist, but you're just one of those science popularizers. You shouldn't be allowed in our clubs. They really treated him badly. The one thing is Feynman didn't get that same treatment. And I've always been curious about that. Feynman's lectures popularizing science were actually very popular in their time. They still are now. He was not blackballed from organizations the same way Sagan was and other science popularizers were, which is really interesting, and I've always wondered why that is. I kind of think, I have this weird pet theory, that it's his accent, because he has this, like, everyday man accent, and so I think people kind of were like, we're so impressed with the fact that the smartest man in the world essentially sounds like the Brooklyn guy from a bad World War II movie that we just want to accept him anyway.
Plus, he's my nephew's father.
Wait, what was that voice?
Yeah, okay. Bobby, that was a perfect Damien impression you did a couple seconds ago. Whoa!
All right, but Ian, would you like to ask Mr. Feynman any questions to expose that indeed it is just Damien?
I was wondering if you could draw us one of your famous diagrams.
All right, right here. Okay, this little thing right up here, that's going to be the clitoris. Okay, this is going to be your roadmap. This is where you're going to be most of your attention's from. Okay, but you know, you go also, there is a labia. And it does need attention as well. Now, I'm going to start driving. Do you like big lips or small lips?
Small.
Good man. Anybody who says they like large lips, suspect. Immediately suspect.
I would just say, let's ask him a very basic question.
I'm going to keep doing this diagram.
Let's
keep
ask
talking.
Him a basic physics question that anybody who had experienced any kind of quantum physics would know. Richard, would you please...
Thank you for acknowledging the fourth wall that it exists.
Yeah, would you please explain how the piezoelectric effect works in terms of quartz crystals? Even just a basic explanation of the effect itself.
Ew, creates like a prism and shit, you know, like lights, you know, breaks it up. And
it's not even close to being true.
Sorry, I'm pretty involved in this diagram. I'm kind of like half listening to the question.
Boom! Prove that it's Damien and not Richard, of course. Those of you who are listening are probably screaming at your radios that the piezoelectric effect happens when you take a quartz crystal and apply any kind of physical pressure to it, releasing an electron in the same way that a photovoltaic cell releases electron when exposed to a photon of light, therefore being a solar cell. These quartz crystals are what power movement watches and stuff. It's the reason you can have a watch without batteries as long as you're walking around. That is something Richard Feynman was no. Boom, Damien, I have proved that you are a faker.
Yo, sorry, I guess my memory was really unreliable with that everyday basic shit. I thought you were going to ask me some sort of extraordinary question that I would fucking remember and shit. All right, well, I've got to go bang some twins and Rosalind Franklin. All right, Feynman out!
That's not what Richard Feynman would say. Anyway.
I've returned. Who was it this time?
Somebody who didn't have as much peanut butter on his balls. It was Damien pretending to be Richard Feynman.
I would remember that. That is definitely out of the ordinary. I would certainly remember that. And whatever sort of perfect, flawless Feynman impression I did.
Well, thank you, Ian, for coming by for Science Faction 246. And thank you, audience, for coming by where you learned about pathologies, a previously unknown source of significant greenhouse gases, how our reality is actually a distortion of our own memories, and why Damien does a horrible Richard Feynman impression. Thank you so much for coming by, and please come on back this Thursday for Science Faction 247.
Hey, it's Richard Feynman here. I made a lot of jokes today about banging your sister. But what's important to remember is that I was also banging your mother. Hey!
You've been listening to Science Faction. Wait, that's not right.